calls for the call center business in Israel. With Shai Reuven, they heard him trying to arrange new credit card processors for Arx Limited. They'll be on us for money laundering and passport fraud if the deals weren't made correctly, LaRue warned. With his wife, Lillian, he arranged for the transport of funds into Brazil through one Eddie, who GISA agents determined was an Israeli working out of Hong Kong named Yoav Hen. Hen landed in Rio on March 28th to deliver $300,000 in cash. The surveillance made clear to the American investigators the scope of LaRue's shift from pharmaceuticals into international weapons and narcotics. In early April, he texted an employee in Hong Kong about a shipment of red phosphorus, a chemical precursor to methamphetamine, bound for Manila by boat. Shepherding the phosphorus, together with a load of computer parts, was Ivan Vaclavic, an Eastern European who, along with Philip Shackles, was one of LaRue's key lieutenants in the drug trade. LaRue alerted Doran Schulman, back in the Philippines, to the impending arrival, instructing him to send a boat out from Subic Bay to offload the computer equipment and leave the chemicals on board. As with the IFUC, the job was undone by a tip. The Brazilian agents alerted the DEA, who in turn tipped off the local authorities, who detained Vaclavic in the boat. Back in Rio, the wires lit up, this time with Vaclavic calling LaRue to report that he was having trouble with the Philippine authorities. He didn't want to say too much. He was being watched by three Coast Guard officers. "I feel like Pablo Escobar," he said. LaRue told him not to worry, that his men would handle everything behind the scenes. Over several more calls, LaRue ordered a safe at one of his properties emptied of 600,000 Philippine pesos, around $15,000. "That should be enough," he said. Not long after, Vaclavic found himself free to go. The wiretaps also gave the GISA agents an unexpected window into LaRue's romantic life, which they gathered was unconventional, to say the least. Having left his wife in the Netherlands and traveled to Brazil with his pregnant girlfriend, he'd also arranged for Eddie to bring in another Filipino woman, with whom LaRue stayed at a condo half a block down the beach from the waterways. At first, the agents assumed the second apartment, which LaRue also owned, was merely a love nest. They dutifully noted his other rendezvous with local women, including the one listed on the Rainbow Force company registration. But after several weeks of listening to LaRue's discussions with Zion Fadlan, his local point man, it slowly dawned on them that something more peculiar was going on. In March, they heard a call from one of the women to Fadlan, informing him that she was having cramps. "Does that mean you're pregnant?" he asked. "I'm not pregnant," she replied. "I'm having my period." "When will you be fertile?" 10 days. When she failed to become pregnant after another series of rendezvous with LaRue, they heard Fadlan arranging a doctor's appointment to assess her fertility. When Fadlan's calls to another local woman also focused heavily on her fertility cycles, it dawned on the GISA agents what was happening. The young Brazilian women in LaRue's employ were receiving a monthly salary to conceive his children. Back in the United States, Brill and Bailey couldn't believe what they were hearing. "That was all on the wire," Bailey said. "It was crazy. You were coming into cycle next week? Like you're breeding two dogs." And she would be saying she wants a big screen TV, and he was like, "I'll talk to the boss." They soon discovered that LaRue had already succeeded in his plan, conceiving with a 22-year-old Brazilian. Wiretapped conversations with Fadlan revealed that she'd gotten pregnant on LaRue's previous trip to Brazil in October 2011. On top of it all, LaRue's girlfriend Kyanen had also given birth in Rio within weeks of their arrival. When Fadlan was heard on the wire making arrangements to officially register LaRue as the father, the agents finally understood the whole picture. With the babies, LaRue was attempting to create a novel kind of legal shield. While Brazil maintained an extradition treaty with the United States, the process for extraditing Brazilian citizens was difficult, and it was generally established that the law provided similar protections to parents of Brazilian children. "He didn't come out and say that, 'We're here to have a baby so they won't extradite me,'" Bailey said, but he was clearly working with his contact in Brazil who was trying to grease the skids. His child with Kyanen, born on Brazilian soil, might give him some protection, but he had to be sure. "The first way wasn't foolproof, so what's another way?" Bailey said, "impregnate a Brazilian." Even years later, agents in both GISA and the DEA remained uncertain whether the citizenship gambit would have worked. But at a minimum, they knew that his Brazilian connections could tie up the case in the courts for years. If they were going to capture LaRue and get him to the United States, they needed to lure him somewhere else, preferably a country from which he could be easily extracted. Since early 2011, as revelations about the vastness of LaRue's activities stacked up and he'd made the CPOT list, Brill and Bailey's investigation had finally begun drawing interest from other quarters of the U.S. government. After years of fighting to convince anyone at the DEA that LaRue was the real deal, they suddenly found themselves fighting off attempts to glom onto the case. Among those who had started taking interest in LaRue were agents in two high-profile sections of the Special Operations Division, where Bailey had once been posted. Known internally as the 959 and 960 groups, they were named for the pair of amendments to U.S. drug laws that empowered them. The 959 provision, dating from 1980s efforts to combat cocaine trafficking, made it illegal for anyone to even attempt to import narcotics into the United States from anywhere in the world. The 960A provision, established by the 2006 USA Patriot Act reauthorization, gave SOD expanded powers to pursue so-called narco-terrorists, drug trafficking organizations connected to terrorism. The two SOD groups were given wide latitude to conduct investigations and bust outside the United States, and 960 offenses came with twice the penalties of typical drug prosecutions. In the years since the September 11, 2001 attacks, SOD's powers and budgets had vastly expanded under both provisions, fueled by a belief in a growing nexus between America's terrorist enemies and the international drug trade. "They have a big budget, and they do big cases," summed up Bailey. Much of the two divisions' work was classified, but 960 had conducted some highly public, and at times controversial, undercover sting operations, in which paid informants played the part of buyers, luring would-be terrorists into drug trafficking, or vice versa. Much of the work involved coordinating with law enforcement counterparts overseas. DEA agents rarely made the actual arrests. In the most famous 960 bust, DEA informants posing as members of the Colombian rebel group FARC helped lure Russian arms trafficker Victor Boot into a sting operation in Thailand in 2008. But at times, 960 seemed to push the boundaries of what qualified as narco-terrorism, using elaborate fake terrorist plots to reel in small-time drug dealers on the other side of the world. LaRue was the real thing, however, a prime 960 target with intersecting weapons and drug operations that spanned the globe. In addition to its resources and international reach, 960 had an advantage over the Minnesota DEA. Brill and Bailey were working with prosecutors from the DOJ's Consumer Protection Division, and after nearly 5 years, they still didn't have LaRue under indictment. Cases pursued by 959 and 960 often landed in the powerful and aggressive U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, headed by Preet Bharara. The office had extensive experience prosecuting complex international cases, including the conviction of Victor Boot. Now Derek Maltz, the special agent in charge of SOD, began referring internally to LaRue as Victor Boot on steroids. At first, the sudden interest at SOD didn't sit well with Bailey and Brill. The 960 group could be condescending, to put it mildly, toward other agents' abilities. To make matters worse, they were horning in on a case they'd once declined. Bailey had worked at SOD, after all, in the pharmaceutical, chemical, and internet division. 960 didn't know shit about this case, Bailey said. "When I was back there, I briefed those guys, tried to get them to take the case, to work the guns, because that was truly outside of Kim's purview. Because that's what you guys do, and you're good at it." And they're like, "Oh, well, that's too hard. We're too busy." But when you spoon-feed and gift-wrap a freaking case, they sit back and say, "What took you so long?" After LaRue moved his operations to Brazil, however, Bailey began to see the logic in letting 960 take on the challenge of capturing the man himself. "I'm the one that told Kim, let them do it," he said. "You can't do all this. This case is too big. They're from SOD. They're not here to take your case. You did all the work. Let them lure him. It's one less thing for us to worry about." Brill came around to the idea, and she and Bailey gave SOD their blessing to run a LaRue sting. They even offered a suggestion on a place to start. Find whoever had talked to the UN investigators about LaRue's Somalia operation. "Somebody," Bailey remembered saying, "has got to get this guy to cooperate." Chapter 25. The Mole. 2012. A call from the DEA. Constructing the ruse. A deal with the Colombians. A sudden request. On a warm evening in February 2012, Felix Claussen was at a beer hall in Dubai with his fiancé when his phone rang. He glanced down and saw a number he didn't recognize. "I never pick up numbers that I don't know," he said later. But for some reason, his curiosity got the better of him, and he answered. On the other end was a friendly American accent. "Hi, how are you? This is Tom," the man said. "I work for the U.S. government." It had been a year since Claussen sent his email to a generic address he'd found on the CIA's website. In the intervening time, he'd managed to put his life as Jack Anderson, who worked for Paul LaRue, and ran a militia-protected operation in Somalia, behind him. He'd even burned his fake passport in front of his fiancée to prove that there was no going back. After a stint managing a hotel, he'd recently been running his own personal fitness training company, but he was considering swapping careers again. His fiancée was growing uncomfortable with his one-on-one training sessions in the homes of wealthy women who, because of Dubai's strict social codes, found it simpler to exercise in private. Now, a man claiming to be an agent from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration was on the phone, telling Clausen that his email to the CIA had been passed to the U.S. Embassy in South Africa, where the agent had come across it. "I was wondering if you would still be willing to talk," he said. For a moment, Clausen wondered if the call might be a setup by LaRue himself. Could he have intercepted Clausen's original email? Since he'd persuaded his old boss to cancel the Joseph Hunter hit, and even garnered a kind of apology for accusing him of stealing, Clausen hadn't felt like he was living under an active threat. "Still, knowing LaRue, you keep it in your mind," he said. "It's automatic, because too many people died." The only contact he'd had with LaRue in the previous year had been after the UN issued its report describing the Somali operation and its collapse into chaos. Clausen already knew most of the details, including that one Zimbabwean had been shot dead in a dispute over the equipment, and that his former Somali point man, Liban Mohammed Ahmed, had been briefly jailed as a result. He was released, but in the meantime, the whole business was fucked, Clausen said. When the organization stopped paying rent, the compound was confiscated, and everything they'd shipped in disappeared. Then the UN report hit the news. "I sent it to LaRue. What the fuck is this?" Clausen said. He said, "Fuck them. They can't do anything. It's just a commission. They have no power." That was the end of it. Now the man on the phone, whose full name was Thomas Sindrick, was able to convince Clausen that he did in fact work for the DEA's Special Operations Division and was investigating LaRue. In fact, he wasn't just looking for information. He was looking for someone who could help take down the organization from the inside. "Okay," Clausen said, "how do you see this going?" "First, we'd like to meet and see what you have," Sindrick said. The meeting would have to take place somewhere other than Dubai, so no one could trace Clausen back to his home. Sindrick proposed Cyprus in a few weeks' time. Clausen agreed. On the appointed day, Sindrick and another DEA agent named Eric Stouch flew through Dubai and greeted Clausen at the gate of a Cyprus-bound flight. Once on board, Clausen took a seat in business class, while the agents who would become his employers trundled back to economy. The DEA had bought his ticket, but Clausen had arranged for his own upgrade. Sindrick and Stouch booked a hotel conference room in Cyprus, where they all sat down to discuss what Clausen could offer. "First, it was me who had to convince them that I have what it takes," Clausen said. But this was a moment Clausen had imagined when he first abandoned the Somali operation back in 2010. He pulled out an encrypted drive on which he had stored reams of material from his time working with LaRue. There were emails about arms purchases, copies of LaRue's IDs, real and fake, financial reports, weapons orders, contact lists. As he walked the agents through the files, he recalled, "They didn't really show excitement, they didn't really show emotion, but it's there, I can feel it, it's in the room." When he finished his presentation, the agents finally let on that they were ecstatic. But the information Clausen had wasn't enough. The agents explained that while the case against LaRue would certainly be bolstered by it, what they really needed was help setting him up. Wherever LaRue was arrested, be it the Philippines, Brazil, or any of a dozen other countries where he regularly did business, there was the potential that he could buy his way out of jail. Sindrick and Stouch needed to somehow get him somewhere where they could control the environment. LaRue wasn't dumb enough to travel to the United States, so it would have to be somewhere else. They would need not only to entice him into his own capture, but also to create an airtight case against him back in the States. To do that, they'd need Clausen to go back to work for LaRue. When Clausen said yes, he, Sindrick, and Stouch became a kind of subunit within the DEA, a team whose work was largely walled off, even from the likes of Bailey and Brill, who were still doggedly working the case from Minnesota. Together, the three of them outlined a plan to lure LaRue into the kind of global sting that the Special Operations Division reserved for the world's most dangerous kingpins. Step one involved Clausen contacting LaRue to ask for his job back. To do that, he couldn't call empty-handed. He would need to bring his old boss the kind of deal LaRue couldn't resist. Every detail had to be perfect. When it was time for Clausen to make contact with LaRue in April 2012, the agents flew him to New York to do it, to help establish a U.S. nexus for the crime. Sitting on the front steps of the elegant federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan, Clausen dialed LaRue's number. He picked up. "How are you?" Clausen asked. "You still have that job for me in the U.S.?" LaRue was friendly, but told him he had given the job to someone else, months before. Clausen said that job or no job, he had something to offer. He had made some interesting contacts in the world of narcotics trafficking, he told him, but lacked his own funds and organization to make anything of them. They are big people, big deals, he told LaRue, Colombians, hundreds and hundreds of kilos. Later, Clausen would marvel that LaRue never questioned why he had such a dramatic change of heart, from quitting the organization over its illegal activities and threatening to turn in LaRue to suddenly approaching him with a Colombian drug deal. He didn't even ask about it, Clausen said, didn't even bother. He knows what people are capable of when they are really in need of money. Most of his employees are willing to cross the line every time. I was one of the first that stood up and said, no, I'm not doing it anymore. It was a bit of a shock for him, but I'm not sure. I don't think you can shock a guy like that. When he came crawling back, he thought, it merely reaffirmed for LaRue his outlook on humanity. See, he imagined his boss saying to himself, he is no different than the others. LaRue agreed to hire Clausen back. He would be working at a lower salary, $3,000 a month plus bonuses. That's how our system works now, LaRue said. After the call, Clausen and his handlers began laying the groundwork for the deal, sending LaRue a list of contacts that Clausen would need to meet with and where. The first stop would be a rendezvous with the Colombians in person. From New York, Clausen and the agents flew to Panama to meet a paid DEA confidential informant who would be playing the role of the Colombian cartel boss. Unlike Clausen, he had some experience with undercover stings. He'd been busted by the DEA years before and began cooperating as part of a plea agreement to keep him out of prison. Now, he was doing it for money. From their meeting in Panama, Clausen called LaRue and pressured him to get on the phone with the Colombian. I'm here with the guy. He wants to talk to you, Clausen said. Nah, don't talk to these people, LaRue said. Come on, they came all the way here, Clausen implored. Just talk to the freaking guy. He wants to meet you, wants to set up a meeting, set up a deal. These people don't deal with lower-level people like me. They want to talk boss to boss. Then he handed the phone to the CI. The imaginary drug boss and the real one conversed for 2 or 3 minutes. Not too much, because of course he doesn't want to give the impression he just talks loosely on the phone. He's supposed to be a professional drug dealer, Clausen said. LaRue didn't like it, but he did it anyway, so I knew he was eating out of my hand. From there, Clausen and the agents began working their scheme around the clock. Their motives may have been divergent. Clausen was out for revenge, the agents for a scalp. But in the intensity of the operation, they quickly forged a bond. Everybody was on full standby 24/7 for 6 or 7 months, Clausen said. Both Stouch and Sindrick had honed their skills as cops on the streets of Baltimore. Stouch, who had also worked as a detective in Pennsylvania before joining the DEA in 1999, was a triathlete, wiry and fit, with a closely shaved head. Eric is the quiet but very observant one, Clausen said. Sindrick, who'd started as a DC cop and had a cynical streak, wore his opinions more on his sleeve. Tom will say what he thinks, Clausen said. If it offends you, it offends you. There were endless debates about when and how to push LaRue, what he would believe, what might make him suspicious. Stouch and Sindrick had the benefit of experience with criminal mindsets, while Clausen knew LaRue, his methods and his madness. Clausen admired how thoroughly the agents prepared him, creating a story with enough details to make it believable, but enough flexibility to adjust on the fly. They always asked me if I was comfortable with it, Clausen said. Always. If I said no, it was no. They never pushed me. At any moment, if I felt uncomfortable, I just had to say the word, and it was done. As the months went on, they methodically laid the trap. If Clausen told LaRue he was meeting a contact somewhere, whether Panama or Paris, he and the agents convened there so that Clausen could always prove his backstory. The guy's not stupid, Clausen said. You can't just tell him a story. He's going to check it. It has to add up. Everything has to be very, very real. They had photos of the Colombian cocaine, newspapers bought locally as casual proof that he'd been there, emails sent from IP addresses in the right location, airline tickets that matched the trip dates he'd given LaRue. For a guy like him, why would he not be capable of hacking into flight manifests, Clausen said, especially for somebody who is that paranoid. Clausen tried to keep LaRue primed with the flow of information about the deal, anticipating his boss's need to weigh in on the smallest details. You have to constantly feed his brain with positive information that you're on the right track, that everything is going smoothly, Clausen said. With evidence, of course, because otherwise he wouldn't believe it. That was the hard part, to keep him out of control, because he's a control freak, and he's got the brain to do it. The Colombians, Clausen told LaRue, were setting up operations in West Africa, centered in Liberia. The cartel, their story went, was interested in making their own meth there. They hoped that LaRue could provide the precursor chemicals and clean rooms to make the stuff, and maybe even meth cooks to train the Colombians on how to make it themselves. In the meantime, they were also interested in buying some finished product from LaRue for distribution in New York. The destination was crucial. To fall under Provision 959, the sting needed to make it absolutely clear that the drugs were destined for the United States. Each detail was perfectly primed to cohere with LaRue's psychology and worldview. The Colombians were the kind of South American partner LaRue coveted. He'd once been rumored to have sent Shai Reuven into the country to make contact with one of its biggest cartels, without success. The idea that the Colombians now respected his knowledge appealed perfectly to his ego. "You have to get in his head," Clausen said. But still, he worried that LaRue could somehow be several moves beyond them. With a guy like LaRue, it's almost impossible. He thinks of a million things in one day. You need a whole team to get around what he's thinking about, what his next move is. He's so unpredictable, it's crazy. Therein lay the problem. It was difficult to tell whether LaRue was truly taking the bait or just playing along. For the first month, Clausen was able to conduct all his business with LaRue via encrypted email and occasional phone calls. But he and the agents knew that at some point, Clausen would need to meet the boss in person. Then, in early May, LaRue sent him a message: book a flight to Rio. The request was typical LaRue, abrupt enough to feel impulsive, arbitrary enough to feel threatening. Whichever was the case, the urgency of it caught Stouch and Sindrick off guard. There was no time to get the diplomatic visas they would need to travel to Brazil. The agents offered Clausen the option of turning down the request. If LaRue somehow already suspected him, he could be walking into a trap. But they knew as well as Clausen that nobody ignored the boss's orders and expected to stay employed. If Clausen failed to show, LaRue would be instantly suspicious, if he wasn't already. Clausen bought a ticket to Rio and booked a cheap hotel, careful to stay within LaRue's $80 a night budget. He wouldn't be using the room anyway. The DEA was paying for a nicer one. Chapter 26, The Investigators. 2012. Big cases, big problems. Weighing a tip. A scramble for gold. New deals in the works. Looking for cooks. In the world of law enforcement, there's a saying so commonly recited that has traveled beyond cliché into the realm of mantra. Big cases, big problems. Little cases, little problems. No cases, no problems. Kent Bailey loved to deliver it with a pause before the kicker. "I'll take big cases every time." In 2012, he would find ample opportunity to use it. Now that GISA had LaRue under surveillance in Rio, and SOD was off working in secret to engineer his capture, the case that had puttered along for almost half a decade began to accelerate. Information that Brill had spent years meticulously corroborating came flooding in, almost as fast as she and Bailey could process it. They could now see up close the kind of control LaRue exercised over the operation, and how he worked to feed his own insatiable hunger for deals. They'd heard him on the phone, specifying the servers required for the office, arranging a 100-kilo drug shipment out of Ecuador, and directing the purchase of airline tickets for Ivan Vaclavic to fly to Brazil, all in the same day. The deluge of evidence was almost dizzying. Which leads should they be chasing first? Who among LaRue's crew was worth taking down? Those questions were about to become very immediate. On April 17th, the wires picked up a cryptic phone call between LaRue and Doran Schulman, now in Hong Kong, operating under the name Justin Collins. "I wanted to confirm the rates for storage for AN," Schulman said. "Hong Kong for storage, 90 per cubic meter." "Okay, no problem," LaRue said. "Things have arrived?" "Yes, they did. I have to talk to the agent not to pay the release fee and confirm." "Okay, no problem. It's confirmed." The next day, LaRue and Schulman spoke again. This time, Schulman was calling with a complication. "Justin, AN arrived. Paul, okay, some problem?" "Justin, some of the bags had runny liquid. I do not know if it's because they were pierced and absorbed water, absorbed moisture." "Paul, liquid? It should be dust." "Justin, there are two types, but one or two bags are wet. Can it be condensation?" "Paul, take one of the bags and test with H1, but not the ones that are wet. Get another bag." "Justin, okay." "Paul, then throw away the ones that are leaking so that they do not contaminate the others." The Brazilian agents now realized what Schulman meant by AN, ammonium nitrate. They knew enough about it to know that its commercialization in Brazil was tightly controlled by the military because of its potential as a powerful explosive. LaRue, it seemed, was shipping it into Hong Kong. They had no idea what the next steps were, nor in whose hands the explosive might eventually end up. They relayed the information back to the DEA. This left Bailey in a quandary. If the DEA tipped off the Hong Kong authorities about the explosive shipment, there was a chance it could start a cascade of events that would drive LaRue underground. If they didn't, people could die. Bailey told the office in Brazil to make the call to Hong Kong. On April 30th, officers from the Organized Crime and Triad Bureau in Hong Kong raided a warehouse in Sen Wan, north of the city. As expected, they discovered a stash of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. The surprise was in the amount, 20 tons of the stuff, divided into 1,000 bags labeled as sodium chloride. Police found Doran Schulman's real name on the warehouse lease, while the fertilizer's shipping documents pointed to a Hong Kong-registered company called Ajax Technology. The cops converged on the company's office on a busy downtown street lined with banks and took Schulman into custody. When the OCTB searched the office and Schulman's apartment, they found bank records for a dozen other companies with names like GX Port Limited, SciComm, and Southern Ace. They also found sale deeds for 2 stash houses, 5 kilograms of pure silver, receipts for tens of millions of dollars in gold bars, and handwritten directions to a meeting in Buenaventura, Colombia, with Luis Caicedo Valendia, a.k.a. Don Lucho, the head of one of the world's biggest cocaine cartels. Schulman's lawyer would later argue that, because of his background as a member of the Dove Devan, the elite special forces unit in the Israeli Defense Forces, he was trained to follow orders without any questions. When told to look after some valuables in Hong Kong, he did it diligently, without any question. Being simple and without experience in finance, he landed himself into deep trouble. In fact, the wires showed Schulman to be deeply embedded in significant parts of LaRue's business, from pharmacy negotiations in the United States to phosphorus shipments in Manila. He had access to the bank accounts of at least 10 of LaRue's companies in Hong Kong, through which more than $200 million had passed over the previous 2 years. Some of that money had been funneled into gold bars, over 300 of them, purchased from a Swiss company called Metalor. In 2010, Schulman purchased a pair of houses in Yen Long and Sheng Shui, each outfitted with a safe in which to stash LaRue's gold. Schulman held the only keys to both safes. Schulman had earned several $100,000 for this work over the years, and in turn had brought on other former Dove Devan colleagues, Yoav Hen, who appeared on the Brazilian wires using the name Eddie, Zion Fadlan's brother Daniel, a.k.a. Gaddafi, due to his Libyan Jewish heritage, and Omer Gavish, a 26-year-old who filled his Facebook feed with photos from his Hong Kong adventures. Each was paid a few $1,000s a month to help guard the gold stashes. When they asked questions about the boss, Schulman told them he was a Dutch businessman and they were better off not knowing more. Now, they were about to learn the rest. Schulman's arrest set off a chain of events in Hong Kong that soon bordered on the ridiculous. On May 1st, the day after the raid, Schulman's Israeli co-workers began to receive messages directly from LaRue, captured on the Brazilian wires, telling them to liquidate his gold. The only problem was, the gold was locked in safes inside the 2 stash houses, and none of them had keys. First they tried getting into Schulman's apartment, but found it sealed off by the authorities. LaRue told them to use brute force. They went to a hardware store, bought some metal cutting tools, and got to work. At the Yen Long house, they pried a safe out of the wall using a crowbar, and then cut a hole in the back, discovering 161 gold bars, which they placed into duffel bags. When they arrived at the second house, they were met by another Israeli employee of LaRue's, who had been dispatched from Manila. After a locksmith dismantled the gate, the group set to cutting open the safe inside. By May 2nd, the 3 or possibly 4 Israelis, in the confusion, the Hong Kong police lost track of a number of LaRue employees, divvied up the gold bars, worth around $18 million, and climbed into taxis. They drove to Chungking Mansions, a sprawling 17-story gray edifice, widely regarded as the cheapest immigrant lodging in Hong Kong, and holed up in a dingy room the organization maintained there. The bags were so heavy that they had to drag them through the lobby. Over the next 2 days, together with a Filipino named Gordo, who had also arrived in the intervening time, they alternated trips to Metalor, selling back the gold where it had originally been purchased. They unloaded 85, then 32, then 64 of the bars, depositing over $9.4 million in the bank account of SciComm, the LaRue-controlled company. In the days that followed, a herd of bumbling LaRue operatives converged on Hong Kong in a frenzied attempt to either keep LaRue's massive store from slipping away or to get some of it for themselves. Besides Gordo, someone traveling under the name John Miller arrived, collected corporate documents for SciComm, and disappeared. The authorities arrested Ivan Vaclavic trying to enter Hong Kong on May 2nd. While out on bail, he cruised out of the harbor in a speedboat headed for the Philippines and then flew on to Rio. There was a mysterious South African, referred to only in passing in the court documents, and another Filipino arrested at the airport holding bank transfer records for $8 million. He, too, jumped bail. As the Israelis desperately tried to hide the remaining gold, scouting a new house in Yuen Long, the police were on their trail. Officers arrived too late at the two stash houses, finding that both safes had been forced open and emptied, but CCTV footage from one of the houses showed a few men loading heavy bags into a cab. The police located the cab company and then tracked the men to Chungking Mansions. At 2:35 a.m. on May 7th, they raided an apartment there, capturing the other Israelis. In their possession were five bags containing 161 gold bars, plus 4 5-carat diamonds worth $1.5 million, and receipts from the previous day's sales. On the wires in Rio, LaRue could be heard working the phones, trying to get what money he could out of Hong Kong. On May 8th, he called Alon Berkman, telling him to transfer as much of the organization's money as possible to bank accounts in Singapore. Next, he called his wife in the Netherlands, instructing her to fly to Hong Kong and transfer their money to the Philippines. Four men are in position, LaRue told her. I think it is safe for you to travel to Hong Kong. I suggest you get there early in the morning, around 8 in the morning, and transfer all the money to Manila. You should have told me this before, she said curtly. I hope you have liquidity in your money. I told you to keep it that way, LaRue said. If you can get into the country, you'll be fine. I'm the target and some of my accounts have already been hijacked. I've already lost a lot of money. Take no extra phone, no credit cards, laptops, just a phone that has only my number from here in the Philippines. Transfer all the money. Take it all away. 2 days later, she was arrested trying to enter Hong Kong on her Dutch passport, carrying a slip for a $300,000 bank transfer. She, too, was released and slipped back out of the country. If Brill and Bailey were worried about scaring off LaRue with the Hong Kong tip, the surveillance in Brazil soon dispelled their fears. The GISA agents were shocked at how quickly he got over the losses. Tens of millions of dollars blocked, one of them marveled later, and he wasn't bothered after a few minutes. LaRue could be heard calmly working through the logistics of bigger deals, most of them real, one of them a setup, unbeknownst to him, that would replenish his coffers even as the Hong Kong seizures depleted them. One of the real ones was a large cocaine shipment set to depart for Asia on a pair of yachts out of Ecuador. A captain was flying in from South Africa and preparing to travel onto the Ecuadorian coast to pilot one of the vessels. On one call, LaRue and an unidentified contact in Ecuador worked out bribe money for the Ecuadorian Coast Guard. Unknown. I need to pay 30,000 U.S. I'll send it to you in the afternoon, and then you have to pay the Coast Guard and these people here. Paul. You cannot do that. There's no way I can send 30,000 by Western Union. Unknown. Or a bank account. Paul. Yes, there is no way to send 30. Not even 3,000. They would ask questions, you know. Unknown. So let me see. Maybe I can give you the name of the Coast Guard and the names of the guys, and you send it to them directly. Paul. Yes, yes, no problem. It can be like this. Unknown. Right, right. I'll tell him to give you the names for Western Union and give you the names of the other people we have to pay, and you send the money. Paul. Right, no problem. All right, my friend. The Ecuador shipment was to be the first in a series of South American cocaine deals, and LaRue made arrangements to hire another South African boat captain named Kevin Ashby to purchase boats in South Florida and deliver them south, where they would be filled with drugs and sent off to markets in Southeast Asia and Australia. It's a cyclical thing, he told Ashby. Buy a boat, you sail it to Panama, use it in Asia, and then go back to the U.S. and buy another boat. LaRue seemed to be taking greater and greater risks, discussing more of his business by phone. In one conversation, he was heard saying he needed 200 kilos of methamphetamine a month. In another, he meticulously arranged the details of getting another $300,000 into Brazil, laundering it through a local currency exchange business that returned him the equivalent amount of Brazilian reals, delivered in an actual clothing box. For years, the federal attorneys working with Brill and Bailey had been telling them they were missing the key piece of evidence to indict him, something that would link LaRue himself to the illegal activities they had so carefully documented. Now here he was, offering those missing links on a wiretapped phone almost daily. It seemed like the time was right to indict LaRue. Brill lined up Robert McGowan and Matthew Smith, along with two other Zimbabweans who were ready to fly to the United States and testify in front of a grand jury about what they knew. The agents from SOD started telling Bailey that, based on what they developed with their own informant, Felix Clausen, whose name remained a secret from Brill and Bailey, the attorneys in the Southern District were ready to indict LaRue themselves. By the summer of 2012, Bailey was pressuring Linda Marks and her team of prosecutors in the Department of Consumer Protection to get their indictment first, based on what they had. Still, Marx held out for better evidence. Then, in a call to his wife, LaRue warned her to stop buying real estate. She should be renting, he said. Buying houses brought attention and gave the authorities something to seize. When his wife resisted, LaRue grew frustrated. Don't you know everything we've been doing is illegal, he said. I'm not running a fucking Burger King. The agent monitoring the wire in Brazil immediately called Brill, who stepped out of a going-away party for a colleague at a Minneapolis restaurant as the agent read her the transcript. That's the moment we needed, she thought. They finally had enough evidence to indict. The two sides of the operation, the Minnesota DEA office and the 960 group out of Virginia, were working their investigations independently, coordinating loosely, yet each partially in the dark about what the other was doing. But in the late spring of 2012, their paths briefly crossed, when the Brazil wire picked up chatter between LaRue and his employees about a major deal with a Colombian cartel, the same deal that the 960 group's informant was busy concocting for LaRue. On the Brazilian wires, Felix Claussen was referenced only as Jack, the go-between with the cartel. On May 5th, LaRue had what started out as a coded phone call with Shai Reuven, the highest-level deputy remaining in the Philippines. I have another job for you, my friend, LaRue said on the recording. I need you to hire us a cook. Right, said Reuven. Yes, I like Mexican food and I want a cook, you know? Yes. There are some guys from Liberia. Liberia, right? Yes. To our partners. We need to send a cook for them, understand? Reuven laughed. You mean a real cook, right? No. I'm talking about methamphetamine, man. Are you retarded? What for? For what? For methamphetamine. I understand. Wake up, LaRue said. Jesus Christ, right? Right. See if you can get one and how much he wants to train some guys over there, right? Understood. No problem. I need a list of chemicals he's going to need, you understand, the way he's going to do things, right? I think I can get one in Florida. I'll let you know. Send me an email. The same day, LaRue told Zion Fodlan, his local helper, that two men would soon be arriving in Rio. One of them, he said, was some guy called Jack, and he already has accommodations. Chapter 27. The Mole. 2012. An encounter in Brazil. The Liberian trap is set. Meeting the Colombians. An in-flight decision. Felix Claussen arrived in Rio for his meeting with LaRue on May 11, 2012. Without his 960 group handlers to back him up, he'd be forced to trust Brazilian agents he'd never met. After he landed, he checked in with LaRue by phone. A local DEA liaison drove him to a hotel, a few minutes' walk from LaRue's condo. There, the GISA team that had been monitoring LaRue arrived to brief him. They were concerned that it wasn't safe for Claussen to go alone to LaRue's apartment. Better that he ask for a public meeting, they cautioned. They could have agents stationed in cars outside, with snipers on the roof and in the condo next door. They'd cleared out the residence with a cover story that they were investigating a pedophile. When you say it's a drug dealer, people can get scared, one of the agents said. But if Claussen was walking into an assassination, they still wouldn't get there in time. You have to be careful, one agent told him. You were dealing with LaRue, not some street criminal. I know him better than anyone, Claussen thought. Demanding his boss meet in public would be as good as announcing he was working for law enforcement. Claussen saw the choice as simple, binary. He could go to the condo and step into the fictional role he had been crafting for months, or he could get on a plane and return to his old life. Anything in between was a waste of time. He called Stouch and Sindrick, who told him that the decision was up to him. Fuck it, he said. I'm going in. A few days later, on May 11th, he was standing at the entry to the Waterways condominiums in Barra de Tijuca. He turned the screw on a wristwatch the DEA had given him, activating its hidden camera. Then he stepped through the doors and took the elevator to the fifth floor. Outside of apartment 505, there were none of the Israeli guards that had once surrounded LaRue in Manila. His boss opened the door and ushered him inside with minimal pleasantries, looking fatter than Claussen remembered. From what Claussen could gather, the only other occupants of the apartment appeared to be one of LaRue's girlfriends and a baby. LaRue suggested they talk on the balcony. He spoke softly, as if to avoid being overheard. The Americans are watching, he said. We have to be careful. Claussen glanced down to the street below them and saw the Brazilian agent's vans. Too easily identified, he thought. He tried to parse LaRue's expression for hints that he knew something more. They walked through the details of the supposed deal with the Colombians, their planned headquarters in Liberia, their desire to build a clean room as part of their own meth lab, and the suggestion that there could be more business down the road. The Colombians planned to ship the drugs to New York City for sale, Clausen reminded LaRue, but they would first need a sample of the meth. LaRue told Clausen it would come out of a batch manufactured in North Korea, that he'd already moved to the Philippines. Sitting on the balcony across from LaRue, Clausen was reminded of how his boss seemed to discuss the most extraordinary aspects of his business in the most casual tones. He's just so relaxed and so calm, talking about death, about murder, about weapons, about wars, he recalled later. Like talking about buying some bread or something. The guy's a genius, but he's a freaking madman as well. Clausen told LaRue that he was on his way to Panama that evening to finalize the details with the Colombians, and emphasized that LaRue needed to meet the Colombian cartel head in person, boss to boss, to put him at ease. LaRue agreed and told him to make arrangements. It seemed almost too perfect. LaRue was signing off on the whole plan, and on tape. As they talked, Clausen held his arm at what he hoped was a natural angle, but one that could capture LaRue on the watch camera. He'd trained with his handlers, and knew that he needed only a brief glimpse of LaRue's face to establish his identity. For the rest, audio would suffice. Suddenly, he noticed LaRue's eyes focusing downward. Following his gaze, he realized that they were aimed at Clausen's wrist. The screw on his watch camera concealed a tiny port, and was attached to the watch by a chain. Somehow Clausen had shaken the screw loose, and now it was left dangling from his arm, like a spider suspended on a thread. LaRue was staring at it. Shitty dive watch, Clausen said, shaking his head. He grabbed the screw between his fingers and twisted it back in. LaRue carried on talking. And then, as abruptly as it had started, the meeting was over, and Clausen was out the door. There was a quick debriefing with the GISA agents. Then Clausen left for the airport. He'd already given the prosecutors enough to indict LaRue for planning to traffic methamphetamine to the United States. Now they just needed to spring the trap. Years later, Clausen would still puzzle over why LaRue had fallen for it all. They had created an alluring ruse, but LaRue at the top of his game was equal parts paranoid and calculating. Maybe I was his kryptonite, Clausen said. For some reason, he had that unconditional trust in me. Trust is a relative thing when it comes to people like LaRue. How he landed in LaRue's blind spot, he could only speculate. I'm not even close to his brain capacity, he said. But I like to care about people. I think that's where we had our biggest differences. He didn't care about anyone. Perhaps he was just desperate, with the DEA closing in on his online operations. Or maybe it was the opposite, as the GISA agent suspected. LaRue felt safe in Brazil and just got complacent. Whatever the explanation, LaRue wanted too much, too quickly, just as he always had. He had the security, he had the safety measures, always able to keep himself out of the picture, Clausen said. Even when he was in the picture, he was able to get out. It was all very well organized. It was very well protected. It was all laid out to be the most perfect criminal empire ever. But he didn't have the patience. After the visit to Rio, the fake deal Clausen was setting up for LaRue progressed as planned. LaRue sent Clausen his bank account number a week later, and the Colombians wired payment for a 24-gram sample of methamphetamine, to be shipped to Liberia and destined for New York. LaRue ordered the sample sent from Manila out of his North Korean stock and supplied them with a tracking number. A few weeks later, Clausen reported back that the Colombians had tested the meth and found that it was clean, nearly 100% pure. LaRue proposed a trade, 100 kilos of meth in exchange for 100 kilos of cocaine. The Colombians readily agreed. To LaRue, it appeared he was the one controlling the direction of the deal. In midsummer, LaRue left Brazil and returned to the Philippines. Even with the law enforcement attention he knew was focused there, he told Clausen, he had unfinished business before finalizing his move to Brazil. In late summer, he would be returning to Brazil for good, and he could pass through Liberia on the way, meet the Colombians, and complete the deal. In the weeks before LaRue left Rio, GISA caught him on the wire making final arrangements for a real transaction, a shipment of cocaine leaving South America headed for Asian markets. In Florida, he'd arranged the purchase of a 44-foot luxury sailboat called the J. Reve, French for I Dream, for $105,000. According to its sales listing, its previous owners had sailed it around the Mediterranean and the Caribbean before giving it up. J. Reve is ready to sail and give a lot of pleasure to its next owner, the ad said. One of LaRue's captains sailed the J. Reve to Panama, where it waited for another skipper to take it south to Ecuador. LaRue's calls with an unknown collaborator in Ecuador were conducted in a relatively simple code. The car looks brand new, his contact told him, to convey that the boat was in place. For Kent Bailey, reviewing the tapes back in the United States, it didn't take decades of law enforcement experience to know that he was listening to a transoceanic drug shipment about to take off. Bailey enlisted in-country DEA agents to meet the boat at its berth in Panama. They arranged a distraction for the crew of the J. Gervais while they placed a tracking device on the craft and snapped a photo of the two men LaRue sent to sail it on its next leg. In August, the boat arrived in Ecuador. Greased by bribe money LaRue had wired into the country, it cleared Ecuadorian customs on August 20th and sailed out with two crew members, Ivan Vaclavic, who had been detained and then released in both the Philippines and Hong Kong, and another man, unknown to Bailey and the DEA. Now they had a chance to follow a major drug shipment in real time and hopefully catch whoever received it on the other end. After a brief stop off the coast of Peru, where LaRue had sourced the cocaine to be loaded on board, the boat began its two-month journey across the ocean. By that time, the wiretap had gone dark. LaRue had departed for the Philippines, where the DEA lacked a window into his movements. As the summer months passed into September, Bailey again pressed Linda Marks to speed up her efforts to convene a grand jury and indict LaRue in Minnesota, but it was too late. LaRue's flight to Monrovia, the Liberian capital, touched down on September 25, 2012. Clausen was already there, having arrived earlier with Stouch and Sindrick to set up and rehearse the sting. LaRue was traveling with his girlfriend, Cindy Cayenan. His right-hand man, Shai Reuven, was meant to accompany them from Manila, but for some reason plans had changed at the last minute. Clausen and a driver picked up LaRue and Cayenan at the airport. "You could see his eyes shining, like he saw potential in that country," Clausen said. "He liked what he saw. We can do good things here." At their modest hotel in Monrovia, Clausen arranged a suite for LaRue, relishing the irony that his penny-pinching boss was being unwittingly upgraded by the U.S. government. The room adjacent to LaRue's was staffed around the clock by Stouch, Sindrick, and several other DEA agents, monitoring video feeds from cameras next door. The next morning, Clausen and LaRue convened at the hotel restaurant for breakfast and planned for their rendezvous with the Colombian that afternoon at another hotel across the city. Just before he walked in, Clausen switched on his wristwatch camera. "Morning," Clausen said. "Hey, greetings," LaRue replied, sounding unusually cheerful. He turned to Cayenan, standing next to him. "Why don't you just hang at another table, okay?" She took a seat out of earshot. "How was the night?" Clausen said. "All good, not a bad place." "Well, like I said, probably the best you can get around here." "Unfortunately, it's raining today, but..." LaRue interjected. "I think it probably rains the whole year here." "Yeah, it's definitely six months, but what to do?" Clausen, knowing his boss, lowered his voice and got down to business. "Wrote a few things down," he said. "You know, I met with the guy in Paris for the Sean thing." In the hopes of layering other charges on top of the Colombian drug deal, Clausen had told LaRue that he had a contact from the Sean state of Myanmar, a semi-autonomous region in the heart of Southeast Asia's Golden Triangle. Sean, which for decades had been rife with armed conflict, was a central hub in the region's bountiful opium crop and its production of yaba, the regional form of methamphetamine. Clausen's source, he told LaRue, was looking for weapons that could take down helicopters conducting surveillance on behalf of the local authorities. "They gave me the details on the helicopter," he said. "It's the U.S. Black Hawk and the UH-53 that's bothering them." LaRue's reaction revealed just how far his own contacts in the international arms underground now extended. "The shoulder-launched missiles they needed could be easily obtained," he said. "Actually, it will be cheap, coming directly from the factory," LaRue said. "The thing is like this. The Russians don't talk on the phone. They are flying to the Philippines to see my guy." "They are good to go with the Russian thing," Clausen said. "They are willing to pay more because they have a certain urgency level." "They have surplus ones being sold from Libya and Lebanon," LaRue suggested. "Lebanon is the main area where this shit is being moved. They can get used ones there if they want. But the problem is to transport them." LaRue spoke slowly and confidently when hashing out the myriad details of these arms deals. Prices, sources, training, shipping arrangements. The South China Sea was a better shipping route than the Bay of Bengal, he noted, avoiding the heavily monitored Strait of Malacca. As to accomplishing the ultimate aim for the weapons, he was happy to offer his advice. "What they need to do is, they need to wait until they are, like, hovering a little close to the ground," he said. "The thing is, they won't fucking expect it. Once the Americans lose some fucking pilots, they won't think twice. You've only got to take one or two down. You don't have to take the whole fleet." With that, LaRue was on to other business. "I want to run one thing by you," he said. "I sent a guy to Iran about 2 years ago. Everything we want, even the biggest shit, is available in Iran. And there's no questions asked. They will deliver to us anywhere, in any Muslim country, anywhere in the world. Like Indonesia, for example. But we need to fetch up there with a general or some fucking lieutenant from an African country, and they front the deal, you know?" Clausen nodded along. I'm telling you, my friend, everything you want. Even shit the Russians won't sell us. We can get from them. Fucking 7-meter-long rockets, if you want. The size of this room, you know what I'm saying? They don't give a fuck. At moments, Luru almost seemed to be enjoying himself. Everything is sweet, everything is sweet, he said at one point, a look of satisfaction crossing his face. Finally, the conversation turned to the Clumine cartel boss they were about to meet. We basically have our talk, I introduce you to him, Clausen said. I call him Pepe, because in Spanish that stands for boss. Just, play a little bit the game, you know. He's very respectful, so I want to be respectful to him as well. Yeah. You will see, you will like the guy. I don't want to make any comparisons, but he's similar, handling business like you do. Just straightforward, no bullshit. Just remind me, what was the trade again, LaRue said, closing his eyes and dropping his head. I forget, there's so many fucking deals. He wanted as much cocaine as the Colombians were willing to give him, but the drug deliveries had to happen offshore. It's better if a boat never pulls into port, he said. You know the Americans, they are not on the ground, but they're always looking, you know what I'm saying? Always. Finally, the meeting wound down as they made arrangements to meet the Colombian at his hotel that afternoon. Before they said goodbye, LaRue had one more question. We need somebody to do a fucking... Is there a laundry service here? LaRue asked, lifting up a bag of clothes. These fuckers charge crazy money. It's like $2 for a shirt and shit here. I'm cheap, dude. For years, Clausen would be unable to shake the image of Paul Calder LaRue, a man who presided over a criminal conglomerate worth hundreds of millions of dollars, refusing to pay $2 to launder his shirt. That afternoon, Clausen's driver took him and LaRue to a nearly empty hotel, where they'd set up to meet the Colombian. When they arrived, Pepe was waiting for them in a room with tile floors and a pair of maroon leather couches arranged perpendicular to each other. Clausen gave him a hug. LaRue shook his hand and settled onto the larger of the two couches, facing Pepe, who sat with the window at his back. Both Clausen and Pepe were outfitted with watch cameras, but that was overkill. The room itself was wired, and the agents were waiting next door. I can see why you picked this place, LaRue said, because it's chaotic. It should be easy to move in and out, from what I've seen. Very easy, said Pepe. Very few people, not too many eyes, LaRue said. It looks like the right place. Trust me. What's your name again? Paul. Paul, trust me. It's the right place. The next half an hour was, as far as the law was concerned, largely unnecessary. LaRue could have been arrested based simply on the meth samples he'd sent, and the conversations he'd had with Clausen about the shipments bound for New York. But the Southern District prosecutors wanted evidence supporting as many charges as possible. Drug dealing, money laundering, arms dealing. So Pepe bounced around details of the drug deals with LaRue, how and when the meth would be delivered, the possibility of paying in gold or diamonds. With each word, LaRue seemed to be turning the locks that would keep him in an American prison for decades. And then the DEA's Colombian informant started freelancing. He abruptly told LaRue he had a friend who was looking for heavy weapons, something more than machine guns. We can do explosives, LaRue said, at first unfazed. We can do all kinds of small arms. Whatever you want, we can get it. The thing with this guy, Pepe said, he wants me to deliver it to New York. Do you have a way to deliver it? LaRue let out a long sigh. That's a tough one, he said. So why does he want it shipped to New York? He wants the heavy stuff to New York, Pepe said, trying to backtrack. When he says heavy stuff, I don't know the details. Well, I don't know, Clausen interjected, nervously. We can see what the details are. The problem is always the transportation, LaRue said, and the conversation moved back to drugs. They had a deal to complete. Beautiful. I think that covers everything, LaRue finally said, when they discussed some more logistics. We talk tomorrow about the details, Pepe said. Beautiful. Paul, nice to meet you. Good meeting you. The video from Clausen's watch camera bounced from floor to wall and back as the men shook hands. He and LaRue walked to the exit, the sound of flip-flops echoing off the tile floors. I think the boss is satisfied, LaRue whispered, as the elevator doors closed. He is, Clausen said. Like I said, he's a nice guy. We're not gonna fuck him, LaRue said as they walked to the waiting car. But the weapons is interesting. It doesn't make sense why someone wants it shipped to the fucking U.S. Yeah, I don't know, Clausen said. That's asking for trouble. That was it, Clausen said later. We went back to the hotel. He returned to his room and downloaded the watch video to a USB drive. When a DEA agent came by and knocked, he slid it under the door. Then he sat down and waited. The end, from Clausen's perspective at least, was anticlimactic. He was idly staring out the window when he saw a group of officers from the Liberian National Security Agency escorting a handcuffed LaRue through the hotel's parking lot. They put him in the back of a van and drove off. Minutes later, there was a knock at Clausen's door. It was Stouch. "It's time to pack your bags. Let's go," he said. Everything so far had run exactly according to plan. But now that LaRue was in custody, it was impossible to predict what would happen next, how soon his operators across the globe might find out, and what they might do. The agents hustled Clausen out of his hotel and checked him into another one. A few days later, he was on a plane to the United States. Later, the agents filled him in on the details of what happened back in Monrovia. How, when the local officers had stormed LaRue's room, the first thing he'd done was slam his laptop lid shut to activate the encryption software, just as he'd always instructed his employees to do. How for a few hours in a local Liberian jail, he'd alternated between raging at the police and offering to bribe them. How, when he first saw an American agent, he had railed that they had no jurisdiction to arrest him in Liberia. None of it worked. The Liberians handed LaRue over to a group of 5 DEA agents, including Stouch and Sindrick. The agents calmly explained that he had been indicted in New York by a grand jury on charges of conspiracy to import methamphetamine, a violation of sections 959 and 960A of the U.S. Federal Code. He would be taken by chartered plane to the United States. "I apologize in advance, but I do not want to get on your plane," LaRue told them, and then went limp. Dragging his body into a van took several agents, like trying to move somebody who's dead weight, Stouch later testified. Once on board and in the air, the agents were exhausted, ready to collapse for the flight home. But suddenly LaRue wanted to talk. It didn't take any clever interrogation techniques, or indeed any persuasion at all, to flip one of the DEA's most sought-after targets, a man who just hours before had been reveling in his ability to obtain unfathomable amounts of drugs and unlimited supplies of powerful military weapons, a man who had routinely ordered even his closest confidants dead. As the plane cruised out over the Atlantic, he seemed to have already decided. First, he congratulated the agents on catching him. Then he said he wanted to talk. "Just promise me I don't die in jail," he said. "That's all I want." He waived his Miranda rights, signed a consent form to search his laptop and phone, and agreed to start telling them what he knew. To Paul, everything is a negotiation, a former 960 agent said. 11 hours later, the plane approached an airport just north of New York City. Paul Calder LaRue was about to step out of view and into a new life of public service. Chapter 28. The Investigators. 2012. LaRue turns on a dime. A boat lost at sea. Chasing Oz and Berkman, the story begins again. A few hours before dawn, on a balmy September morning in 2012, Kimberly Brill and Kent Bailey stood on a tarmac in White Plains, New York, awaiting a plane carrying the man they'd been chasing for 5 years. Beside them was Derek Maltz, the special agent in charge of SOD. Weeks ago, the plan had been different. Maltz had agreed that Brill should travel on the mission to capture LaRue in Monrovia. But the agents from 960 had pushed back, insisting there was no room for her on the flight. Instead, Brill and Bailey had been invited to meet the plane when it arrived. It was an ominous sign of things to come, but on this morning, at least, Bailey recalled that Maltz was in a complimentary mood. "Kent," he was telling me, "I'll never forget the first time you briefed me on this case. You were absolutely right. This guy is the largest international criminal that I've ever dealt with." The plane touched down around 3 a.m., and Bailey noted to himself that it seemed large enough to have accommodated not just Brill, but a dozen more agents. The investigators from Minnesota caught a quick glimpse of LaRue as he lumbered down the stairs, handcuffed and wearing a pair of cut-off sweatpants and a polo shirt. Then the SOD agents hustled him away, loading him into an SUV headed for the Metropolitan Correction Center in Manhattan. Brill and Bailey had booked rooms in a downtown Brooklyn Marriott, just across the East River from the MCC and the offices of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District. They'd been preparing to join in the initial questioning of LaRue, who was scheduled for his first formal court appearance later that morning. After breakfast, they decided to walk over the Brooklyn Bridge, together with an agent from SOD, to attend the hearing. Partway across, the agent got a phone call. The hearing was off. Hours before, LaRue had met for the first time with a court-appointed attorney named Jonathan Marvini, and promptly signed an agreement stating his intention to cooperate. The deal affirmed what he'd declared on the plane. He was ready to help. The 960 agents were hustling him to a hotel room at the same Marriott where Bailey and Brill were staying to begin debriefing him. Bailey turned to Brill. "Well," He's on Team America now, he said. There would be no press conference announcing the capture of one of the most prolific criminals the DEA had ever faced. The agency had other plans, which now required that no one know that LaRue was off the street. They'd snatched him out of view of any of his employees or associates, and now he would start working from DEA custody as if he were still at large. It took Bailey and Brill the better part of that day to realize they were being shut out of LaRue's case. The U.S. attorneys in the Southern District who'd obtained his indictment now had control of LaRue, and they didn't intend to relinquish it, no matter who had first opened the case or how long they'd spent on it. We waited all that day. We never talked to him, Bailey said. An agent from SOD advised Bailey to return home to Minneapolis, but he demanded that he and Brill receive a briefing on LaRue's status. It probably wasn't until dinner time, 6 or 7. I wasn't leaving until we got a briefing, Bailey said. I think they probably hoped we would go away. That evening, Bailey sat in a bar with a group supervisor at SOD, who told him that LaRue had offered not just to help catch his associates, but to share information about dealings he'd had with Iran and North Korea. He was now more than a drug and arms dealer, the supervisor said. He was a national security asset. At the bar, Bailey warned that LaRue was smart enough to manipulate them, if the agents weren't careful. Don't get enamored with him, he told the supervisor. He's a killer. Don't start dancing here, because he can sell you a song. On both sides of the DEA, the ambitions that emerged from a prize like LaRue had begun to harden into resentment. Bailey believed that the case belonged to Brill, a diversion investigator who had devoted 5 years of her life to it,